WUVS LP 103.7 Muskegon, Muskegon Heights.
News and programming on WUVS is brought to you by Grand Valley State University. Grand Valley State University is thrilled to be a supporter of your community radio station. Learn more about Grand Valley State University at www.gvsu.edu. Grand Valley State University, proud supporter of your community station, 103.7 The Beat.
Hello, Muskegon. I am Pastor Anthony Hall, Community Service Director for Muskegon Family Care. And as a federally qualified health center and patient-centered medical home, Muskegon Family Care strives to assist patients in overcoming barriers to their health care. We practice a model of care that strengthens the provider-patient relationships, providing the more personalized, coordinated, effective, and efficient services. We invite you to become a part of our family, Muskegon Family Care, located at 2201 South Getty Street, Muskegon Heights, Michigan, 49444. We are also accepting new medical and dental patients. Please contact us today to schedule your appointment at 231-739-9315. Again, that number is 231-739-9315. Thank you.
The exhibition Common Ground, African American Art from the Flint Institution of Art, the Kalamazoo Institution of Art, and the Muskegon Museum of Art will be on a view at the Muskegon Museum of Art through March 20th, 2016. Drawn from the Three Michigan Museum Collection, the exhibition will highlight some of the most important African American artists from the 19th century to the present day. This exhibition will survey African American art through 60 works of art in various mediums, including paintings, works on paper, and sculptures. This event is open and free to the public.
They promised some of the biggest hits. Now they return for the Bad Boys Reunion Tour, February 13th, in DeVos Performance Hall. It's Faith Evans. Valentine's Weekend. Look who's back. It's Mace.
Who's hot? Who not?
Also featuring Carl Thomas. And Case. Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster and the box office. Don't miss the Bad Boys Reunion Tour. A Smash production.
Sponsored in part by the Kent County Convention Arena Authority.
This hour of WVS programming is brought to you by West Michigan Association. West Michigan Association is having a Show Me the Money Day on Saturday, January 30th, 2016, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Christ Temple Apostolic Church, located at 412 East Sherman. They will be offering free workshops to manage your money, better banking, own your own home, and much more. Free food and prizes will also be available. Sponsored in part by 103.7 The Beat.
It's PDA with the afternoon show. Call your mama, call your sister, let them know. All through the beauty shop is 103.7 The Beat. The latest music, bob your head, move your feet. Turn your speakers up, it's 103.7 The Beat. Play it loud in your Chevy and your Jeep. Just real talk from the office to the streets. It's PA broadcasting from the skin. Trying to bring together our community. Important issues that affect you and me. Where the party at? Turn it to the beat. It's the driving fire, time to hit the streets. It's PA, listen to him speak. It's PA on the afternoon creep. It's PA with food for ears to eat. It's PA on 103 The Beat. We got local, national, world news. We got exclusive music and interviews. 103 on the fire, who you listening to? 103 on the ones and the two. 103.7 The Beat.
I'm Dwight.
I'm Linda.
You're listening to 103.7 The Beat.
Down the connection.
Not sure if you got a chance to hear the Muskegon Heights Mayor Kimberly Sims, her city, her State of the City speech yesterday from Muskegon Heights City Hall, which we ran live here at 103.7. The Beat did have a few technical problems. She was actually wearing a cordless mic, and that was not anticipated. She was out in the crowd, so not sure if you all got a chance to hear it very well via 103.7 The Beat. But some of the things she talked about was avoiding an emergency financial manager coming in to the city of Muskegon Heights, in essence taking over the city of Muskegon Heights, as they've done in other communities here in Michigan, particularly large communities with the majority of the population of African Americans. And that's happened in other cities, did not happen in the city of Muskegon Heights. And the mayor said that that was something to celebrate. Of course, it was a full house yesterday at the Muskegon Heights City Hall. She talked about how in 2009 they were proactive and put a plan together. They were on the receivership list at that time, but it didn't happen. And she said because of previous mayors, the former Muskegon Heights City Manager Natasha Henderson, who is now, interestingly enough, the city administrator of Flint. But at that time, they made painful, necessary cuts to the city budget, and deficit was eliminated. And as of now, the Muskegon Heights projected general fund balance is somewhere around $1.5 million. Mayor Sims also said the city of Muskegon Heights is in a better place as the result of the diligence and tenacity of this council, past mayors, and the community. Kim Sims said that she would communicate with the general public as a part of her campaign when she was on the stumping ground. And that's what took place yesterday in her very first State of the City speech. Keep it locked. This is the Chill Will Throwback Mix. Hope you enjoy it. JC sitting in for PA.
Could it be my bag of jeans or my gold teeth that make me different from y'all? Ain't trippin', dawg, but listen, dawg, I was raised a little different from y'all. Doing my thing, using my ghetto slang, and I'm representing thugs. So those who roll with me, watch them boys that gon' blood. So them ones who I don't bond, on the run, I got 10 years on parole. Can't say it, dawg, I'ma say it for y'all. Never trust the popos. Don't trust the judge and CEO. Not the DA and PO. Not the family or the victim, witness, ask me. See, I'm so tight, baby, like that boy got so many. And I know he got clout, look in his mouth, that boy got so many goals. And if he tell a nigga, it's something up with that fool.
Live from the Maze and Wright Media Center, it's Straight Talk with DJ Hilson, your Muskegon County prosecutor. Straight Talk with DJ Hilson, an in-depth discussion on issues that affect you and your community. Sparking conversation, opening dialogue, and breaking down barriers. Have a question about crime prevention, subpoenas, silent observer, or about the law? Call 231-722-8338. It's Straight Talk. Straight Talk. Straight Talk. With DJ Hilsey. DJ
Hilsey. Hey, good evening, Muskegon. DJ here. Sorry, we got a late start.
Wasn't my fault.
It wasn't Rob's fault. I was coming from, I had a meeting that started at about 3:30, and it went right at 5. Now, the good news was it was just up the street, but I had to, you know, these one-way streets really got, you know, they delayed me. But I had to circle the block to come back around to get here.
You're the chief law enforcement officer for the county of Muskegon.
That means I have to obey every law.
You can't just throw a light on top of yours and say, I'm the county prosecutor. Got to go.
Yeah, get out of my way. No, you know, it's probably a good thing they don't give me a light. It's probably a good thing they don't. You know, because I've been tempted. I'm sure you all, some of you listeners out there, have been in this situation where you're driving and you're obeying the laws of the road, and you've got some idiot out there that isn't. You know, I oftentimes just kind of look. And I look for the button that I can push that'll turn my flashers on, but I don't have it. Just to send a message, not necessarily.
You don't want to pull them over.
A little message.
We're here.
Now I have to say, in full disclosure, that this was several years ago, mm-hmm. And I wasn't even in Muskegon. I was driving. My wife and I were in Ludington. I can't remember where we were going. Maybe we were coming back from something. I don't remember. But driving, minding my own business on Highway 10, trying to get to 31 so I could head back south to home.
Mm-hmm.
And some idiot was tailgating me quarter mile, half mile, for no reason. And so I did. I pulled out my badge. And as he passed me, I put it in the window just so he knew that it was probably not a good idea to do that. That's the only time I've done that.
That's the only time you've done it. What's been going on at the county building? I seen, what was that, TV8 today down there? You had something big going on?
Well, listen, everybody is, rightfully so, is wanting to get some information on this discovered body that was found out in Fruitland Township Friday. And, I just actually did a little interview with ZZM 13 today just to tell, you know, folks that everything is still under investigation. I have not received the official confirmation yet of who that person is from the ME's office. We're waiting on that. And so there have been snooping around trying to, you know, get the story. And I've told all the media outlets that, you know, for the integrity of the investigation and for the safety of those involved, that, I cannot confirm information they're asking me to confirm. And certainly I don't know the positive identification of the body yet. Obviously once we get the official word, we'll make sure that we let folks know. The important thing for me is that the first folks that get to know that is in whomever we officially get the identification. We're going to notify that person's family. They get it first. So that's why News 8, I've been getting phone calls and texts and whatnot from reporters.
See,
and
we didn't bother you.
I know that.
I knew you were coming in, so I was going to ask when you got here, so you just answered it.
So. I did. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, obviously, you know, in today's day and age, in today's media, you know, everybody wants to be first. Everybody wants the scoop, you know, wants to be able to claim that they're the best news organization because, you know, they got the information first. And, there's a part of me that tries to recognize that. But the other part of me is that, one, you know, as in particular, when we're dealing with information as it relates to criminal investigation, there's a lot of information, in particular, in the early onsets of an investigation that, you know, we don't want out because it may be a piece that we need to make sure that whomever we're talking to knows what they're talking about. Or it may be so unconfirmed that releasing it would be wrong. It wouldn't be right. You know, for me as a lawyer, we have ethical obligations. There's actually a section in the Professional Code of Conduct that talks about how lawyers talk to the media. In particular, there's one on prosecutors and how, you know, what we're what we can and what we can't say. And if you think of it from a common sense standpoint, that I can't try my case in the media, and nor do I want to. And so there's a lot of things that I can't talk about. And it actually makes my job a lot easier because if a media outlet asks for an interview, I believe in transparency, and so I usually oblige them. But I always tell them up front, I can't answer questions about this. I can't answer questions about that. I can give you some basics, and that's about it. And, you know, media being what media is, they always like to push the envelope, and it's always very easy to say, I can't answer that.
Oh, okay. Now, some people will ask the question, say, well, why is it when a criminal did something, you guys will give their whole rap sheet? But when a police officer or a county administrator or something like that does something, y'all don't put out what they have done or what they've been, their background is, besides the police or the county administrator?
Well, you know,
well, I'm just playing the devil's advocate.
One, you have to have a background to give.
Okay.
So typically, I'm not saying this is the golden rule, right, but typically, absolutely, the two positions you're talking about, whether it be county administrator or police officer, they typically don't have a criminal history. And what we talk about when we're asked is usually what's already printed on the information. So, for instance, if we charge somebody with a serious crime and let's say they have a prior history of felony convictions, what the news asks is what's printed already on the public file on the information. So I'm not giving them anything that they couldn't get on their own. They'll ask, you know, about prior convictions and whatnot. And so we talk about that because it's there. It's already there in a public document, something that the public can see, something that the news media can have. So I usually don't talk about anything outside of that. You know, if we had an officer or a public official that had some issues in their past, mm-hmm, we'll talk about it. I mean, I have no qualms about that. I mean, you know, if you've done something wrong and it's relevant to what you're being charged with, we're going to talk about it, mm-hmm, or we're going to mention it because, you know, that the people are going to ask that question.
Right. How's the jail coming? I know people want to know that, and I know that's not really your department, but
well, my understanding, yeah, my understanding is it's up and running. It's operational. I mean, from the Sally Port to holding to, you know, the pods, everything is up and running. I had a meeting with the jail administrator Monday on another issue and was asking him that question. And you know, outside of some minor things that they're trying to take care of, you know, it's operational. It's you know, inmates are there. The old facility, for all intents and purposes, is not holding inmates anymore. And you've got, you know,
The transfer is complete.
It's complete. Yeah, we're rolling. So,
okay. How are things with the? You brought up. Well, let me ask you this first. You brought up about, you know, people trying to get the information, and maybe you need to explain to people, if a body is found, what is the? Because I know it's a lengthy process. What is the process before you can say this is Robert Roundtree? Mm-hmm. We found bullet holes in his head or whatever the case may be.
Well, I mean, a lot goes into it. I mean, obviously, we have to identify who the person is that we're dealing with, or who the, you know, victim is. So they have to be identified, and then proper notifications have to go out to relatives or family. That has to happen. And then it's a matter of, you know, the process and speed of the investigation itself. We don't automatically start confirming maybe the nature of the wounds because, you know, as we go through the investigative process, that bit of information may be important or relevant when we're talking to a potential suspect. So a lot of times we may confirm that a person was stabbed or shot, but we may not confirm where or how many times or caliber or anything of that nature, because we want to use that as part of the investigation process when we're dealing or talking to a potential suspect who would know that information and be able to answer, or you know, and we would know that we're talking with somebody with knowledge because they were able to answer those questions appropriately. So it really is a combined effort when we're dealing with that situation between law enforcement and in my office on what we're going to release, what we're not going to release, what we can release, and what we can't release due to ethical obligations. And so, you know, it's really a case-by-case basis. And a lot of times, you know, we work with law enforcement because there's information. If we're looking for somebody or we're looking for, like, say, a vehicle or something, where we will coordinate a press release to inform the public, this is what we're looking for, and if you have information, here's who you can call. And so we use the media in that fashion as well. You know, I'd like to think that, for the most part, the media tries to do the right thing, and I say for the most part. You know, there are some outlets that are a little less rule-abiding than others, and you know, and we know who they are, and we certainly control the amount of information that those particular outlets get. Because at the end of the day, I'm not going to compromise an investigation or a case, for that matter, just to satisfy the media's wanting of information. When it's appropriate, the appropriate information will get out. Like I said before, I'm very transparent when it comes to that. I have zero to hide. And, you know, I want to make sure that the public is informed as to what's happening.
Oh, okay. Are prosecutors obligated, you know, to tell the public anything, or is that just a courtesy y'all extend to the public?
I think that's a courtesy. You know, I'd like to think that if you look at the western side of the state in particular, that Muskegon County is probably one of the more transparent counties when it comes to that. You know, I know my colleagues in Ottawa and Kent and up and down the coast, they don't they typically don't oblige to media requests. And I don't, personally, I don't go looking for it. You know, if something is going on and they're looking for a comment or a quote, or they're looking to have somebody come on camera, depending on what it is, I'm happy to oblige by that, but I certainly don't go running around looking for it. I've got far too many other things to do and worry about than to get on camera or you know, step into the step in with a reporter. So, but when it's appropriate, you know, I do oblige them because I think it's important, again, that the public has that information and that we make sure that we provide it in an accurate way and fashion.
Okay. I was also reading y'all, not y'all, but the jury.
Y'all?
Y'all. I don't know why I said that.
Yeah, I don't
know what's wrong with me.
What you got?
The jury in the Altman, Ishmael James Altman case, yep. He had been sentenced to at least 7 years in prison.
Yeah.
Was that today?
That was today.
Okay. Now, they said that he was in charge with open murder at first. I thought open murder was automatically life.
No. Open murder.
Can you explain that?
Yes, sir. Be happy to. Great question, Mr. Rob, Mr. Big Rob. No, open murder is a general charge. Open murder covers all spectrums of murder, so first degree, second degree, and manslaughter. All right? What we're telling the court and what we're telling the defendant is that, and it's a short little one-liner, you know, John Doe did commit the murder of Jane Doe, and that's it. And so what that gives us the ability to do is not commit to a theory right then and there, but it leaves all theories open, okay? Hence the term open murder. So a lot of times what happens is that charge then carries on to the trial phase, and at trial, when we're giving our opening statements, when we're telling the jury, this is what our theory of the case is, and here's the evidence that you should anticipate seeing, we're committing to a theory at that point. Typically, it's first degree. Sometimes it's second degree. And so all that does is it leaves all those things possible. That's what that means. And so Mr. Ottman was charged with open murder. He pled to manslaughter about a month ago, and he was sentenced today, this afternoon. In fact, I handled the sentence today. So I actually handled, that was my case. So I handled
the whole case was yours?
That was my case, yeah.
Wow. Okay, when a defendant gets credit for time in jail.
Yeah.
How does that work convert into the prison systems? And the only reason I'm asking is because it seems as though the daughter, the 17-year-old daughter of this young lady, it looked like she made a statement to the press that she's not angry at this guy mm-hmm. or blames this guy. I'm going to get to what she actually said.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
I don't know if she made a statement. I know the attorney during the sentence today made a statement that the daughter didn't really have any ill will towards Mr. Ottman, the daughter of the deceased, the driver of the vehicle. You know, to, I guess, go back to your original question, time served, I would say for a majority of cases, when you are in jail awaiting disposition of your case, you are every day that you serve is a day that you get credit for that goes towards your sentence, all right? So in felony cases, when prison is involved, every day that you're serving awaiting either trial or disposition or sentence or whatever it is, that's a day credit you get with the DOC, all right?
Okay.
So in this case, Mr. Ottman received 7 years. Actually, it was 2 plus 5 for a total of 7. So 2, mandatory 2 on the felony firearm conviction and 5 on the manslaughter conviction for a total of 7.
Mm-hmm.
He is getting credit on the 2 years because you have to serve that first.
Okay.
It's a consecutive sentence. Mm-hmm. Right? So his 200, I think it was 209 days of credit
yes.
are going towards that felony firearm sentence. All right.
Okay.
So once that sentence is served, then he starts serving the 5 on the manslaughter conviction.
And that's just, you're not saying this is the total time he got, because from what I'm reading, he got 2 for the weapon.
Yep.
He got 5 to 15.
Yep.
For
the actual
death. Offense,
yep.
the death. So we're saying 7, speaking of just minimum.
Yes.
Not the minimum and maximum.
No, well, the important numbers are the first two numbers.
Oh, why is that?
Because in Michigan, we have what's called truth in sentencing, okay?
Okay.
And truth in sentencing means that whatever you get for your minimum, that's what you're serving, all right? And that includes, obviously, you're getting the credit you get for the time you've already mm-hmm. served, all right? Mm-hmm. So his first chance, Mr. Ottman's first chance of seeing the parole board is after 7 years,
mm.
all right? Then he'll be up for parole review, and the parole board then decides whether he stays because he's been a bad inmate or whether he's parole eligible.
Okay.
Okay, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the 15, the mm-hmm. maximum, is the maximum that the DOC can hold on to Mr. Ottman. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So if he is a really, really bad prisoner, just not a model prisoner, really bad, the maximum the parole board can hold him inside the prison is 15 years. At 15, he's maxed out, and he has to be let go. And when you max out, you max out even out of supervision. So you're not supervised at that time. You've just served your time.
Mm-hmm.
So the gap between 5 and 15 then gives the parole board, if you are going to get paroled, a determination of how long you're going to be on parole supervision.
Okay.
And I don't know how they determine that,
right,
but they
right,
have a
right.
system where they determine how many years after you're released from the facility you're on parole supervision. And that's important because, obviously, if you violate parole, then you're subject to essentially you're subject to going back to the DOC.
Mm-hmm.
to serve out whatever term they decide is appropriate for your violation. And the sticky part is if you commit a new crime while you're on parole, and let's say you go back inside the jail awaiting disposition on that new crime, you are not getting credit for time served. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of your parole status, you don't get credit on your new crime. So every day you're serving for the new crime while on parole is what we call dead time, essentially. You're not getting credit for that. if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? So that's the difference. Probation does not have that same distinction. Only parole does.
Only parole.
Only parole.
And just to make a correction and to concur with what you were saying, DJ, what it says in the article from MLive, and I am quoting, this is a strange, bizarre set of facts. I don't know. I hope I'm saying this person's name right.
Dave, Quartering. Dave Quartering, yep.
Quartering said he had no intention of hurting anyone that day. He had no intention, certainly, of his girlfriend, Peggy Sue Everett. Peggy Sue Everett being killed that day. He said Everett's family didn't submit a victim impact statement and that her 17-year-old daughter doesn't hold Altman responsible for her death.
Right.
Okay. How much in a case, in any case, how much weight does the victim impact statement or a victim statement have on the sentencing of a defendant?
You know, that's a really great question. We as an office, one of our I guess philosophies and ideals is that we are very victim centered, very victim focused on major cases. Well, in any case, but in particular on major cases, we always talk to the victims, whether it's a victim of the crime because they've survived the crime or a victim's family. And my philosophy has always been is that I want to make sure that their questions and concerns are being answered, that they're not getting the information from any other source but me, and that they have the opportunity to provide input along the way. Now, our job is to advise them of the legal pitfalls and whatnot that we may face along the way. And, you know, when it comes time to making critical decisions on whether or not we're going to make an offer to somebody, whether or not, you know, we're going to agree or convince the judge not to make a sentence commitment, those are all critical points where we absolutely make sure that the victims are heard and are fully aware and part of the discussion. Because at the end of the day, I want to make sure that we're all on the same page so that when something happens, everybody who's connected to that decision knows that that's the decision that's going to happen. So, I mean, the bottom line is that, we listen very carefully to the victims' questions and concerns. We consult with them. We provide all the legal advice, and we give our recommendations. I'd like to say that theory, that way of working has always been a solid way of making sure that the level of communication stays at the highest level. Because ultimately, that's what it is. It's about communicating and making sure that everybody has that opportunity to express their concerns. And then, you know, by constitution, victims of crime have the absolute right to address the court at the time of sentencing. That is their right. That's their constitutional right. And so we provide that opportunity. Now, a lot of times victims don't want to do that. They just want to be there. They just don't want to say anything. And that's okay. That's a personal decision. You know, we never talk anybody out of whether or not they're going to talk or not. If they want to spend 5 minutes addressing the court on that situation, they're going to get their 5 minutes because they have that right. And I don't think that that right should be taken away from them, quite frankly. They have an opportunity to express what they're feeling, you know, maybe address the defendant. That happens. Address the court, making sure the court understands where they're from, where they're coming from. All that is all very important, not only for the process, the court process itself, but I think it has a lot to do with the healing process as well. You know, because the court system isn't going to provide the complete closure that everybody is looking for, but it does provide a piece of that closure. And so in my experience, the more actively that victims participate in that, the more closer they get to getting that closure, as close as they can. I really believe that. And I think, you know, and I've seen it. So, I mean, to me, I always appreciate victims that are very in tune, very active in the process. Because one, it really keeps us on our toes. And two, it never lets us forget, you know, what we're doing and who we're doing it for. Because, you know, you know, listen, folks, when you when you're dealing with hundreds and thousands of cases in a year's time, you know, by human nature, sometimes you can lose that perspective. And so keeping that open door of communication, that open door policy that I love, really keeps us in tune with what our job is.
Have you ever seen it where a victim came to court? They followed the case and all this kind of stuff like that and made sure their concerns and things were addressed and then got up there in front of the judge and said, I don't want to see this person locked up.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever had that in the years that you've been an attorney? And if you have, what was the response of the judge or the prosecution?
Yeah, it does happen. You know, the one case that really is unbelievable to me and to this day is unbelievable is if you recall back when we had our first solicitation to commit murder. It was a woman, her husband was in the Coast Guard, I think, if I'm not mistaken, and her husband showed up at the time of sentence. And she put on, in my opinion, now this is my opinion, folks, she put on a big show, crocodile tears, the whole ball of wax. I had her husband, who had seen, you know, the whole plot to kill him, you know, her absolute desire to have somebody break into their house, shoot this man in the face, so she could collect the insurance money. He knew all of that and stood before the court and said, you know, sending her to prison just isn't the right thing to do. Now, listen. I am a big believer in second chances and forgiveness. I'm not trying to disparage that. But I also think that when it comes to that situation, I was shocked because my position was polar opposite to his. As I stood next to him, he said that, and I was saying something far different. And that sometimes happens. That sometimes happens because, again, you know, obviously, we try to stay lockstep with our victims.
Yes.
But also, you know, the other part of our responsibility as prosecutors is to make sure that the public is safe, that that the proper message is sent when somebody commits a crime. And so we wear two hats. And sometimes those hats agree and sometimes they disagree. That doesn't mean that we don't respect what the victim is saying or asking. But our position is different, and you know that's just the way it is. You know, and sometimes you know if it's a situation and the crime involved a family, you know, it was a family situation. We understand and basically let the court make the decision and don't advocate strongly for one way or the other, because the court understands what the dynamic is and we understand what the dynamic is. But in that particular situation. Listen, you go out to hire a hitman, and it's on video. And at that time, it was all over the national media.
Yes, it was.
We're not signing on for the just let her come home, Judge. That ain't happening. Not while I'm standing there. That's not happening. So, yeah, that was probably the one that sticks out the most, and I probably will never forget because. You know, as I look back and I look at some of the media coverage, as he's talking, and you can see that I've got my kind of my I'm not looking at him. I'm just kind of looking down at the desk. Just probably, if memory serves me correct, in utter disbelief that these words are coming out of this man's mouth. And so, you know, but again, you know, you have to maintain your composure. And it's pretty easy to do when you got like five TV cameras staring at you, waiting for you to, you know, do something stupid. So, it was quite an event.
Do you remember what the judge gave her as a sentence?
Yes, she went to prison. I do know that. It was for, I think it was like 4 and some years, or 5 years and some months, if I remember correctly, or 4 years and some months. But she did go to prison. It should still be there, actually. So in the end, she's not coming home for a while yet.
Now, in a case like that, I know you put in place no contact orders and things of that nature. What if the victim goes to see the person in a prison and then turn around, you know, there's a no contact order in place, or they try to see him at the jail or something like that because there is a no contact order in place. Can the victim go to the court and be like, well, I don't feel threatened. I want this contact order released so I can go see my loved one and things of that nature.
That happens every time. In particular, it happens a lot in domestic violence cases. I appreciate our position is always, you know, I would say 9 times, if not 10 times out of 10, we object and leave it to the court's discretion because, you know, a lot of times those decisions are being made and they're not being made with, a full set of faculties, you know, for lack of a better way to describe it. But, you know, the court actually has a really nice system in place, in particular for domestic violence cases. When that happens, prior to the court actually signing the order, dropping the no contact, they actually have to go down and visit with the legal advocate, who I think is every woman's place advocate. They actually have to sit down and talk it through with them, and that person has to sign off on the fact that they have sat down and talked to them before the court even considers dropping the no contact. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. There's a lot of factors that go into that decision because, you know, ultimately, you know, the one of the downsides to domestic violence outside of the violence part of it is the fact that if this has been an ongoing situation, the victims become, they sort of get caught in that cycle, and they will do things like, want to be back with their abuser. Because they become so dependent on that person for whatever reason, mentally, for whatever reason, that they start doing these things. And, you know, from an outsider looking in, you look at that and going, you got to be kidding me. But you got to recognize the mental side of it. To this day, we prosecuted an individual who had a history of domestic violence, who beat this woman up really badly. The pictures were pretty, I mean, you could tell. I mean, it wasn't like a little scratch. This were bruises and whatnot. This woman did everything in her power to try and thwart the prosecution of this guy. And even after we were successful in convicting him without her cooperation, she, I think, went on my website or my Facebook page and blasted us, And again, okay, I mean, I want to sympathize with what you're doing, but you're not protecting yourself. And our job is to make sure that we do everything in our power to protect you. And either you're going to cooperate with that situation or you're not going to cooperate. But at the end of the day, I'm not satisfied. My assistants aren't satisfied with you saying, you know what, I just want to drop the charges. Nothing happened. Oh, no, that's not true. Something did happen, and we got to address it. Because if we don't address it, it's not going to get any better. It's really not going to get any better.
I can understand that, and I see where you're coming from that. I see where the court's coming from that. But have you ever had a case where the neighbors called because they heard this lady screaming, yelling, heard of fighting or whatever and stuff, and the police get there and she's got bruises all over and stuff, and you find out that she's like, well, that's a game we play, you know, because the way things people are today, they do some, what we may think is weird is normal to them.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you take this person to jail and it's like, hey, I didn't do nothing but what we normally do, but the neighbor called the people and stuff. You ever had a case like that?
Well,
and you had to sort through the stuff and be like, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Not if this is a mutual agreement now. Nah,
hey. Yeah. Well, you know, I can't say specifically that I've had that or seen that situation. It's not to say that it hasn't happened. But in the same vein, you know, the circumstances that you talk about, yes. I mean, where you've got a third party reporting it, and both parties are saying, hey, listen, I don't know why they called. This is whatever. Now, I think from an officer's, you got to understand now, if you put a police officer's hat on, okay, walking into that situation, right, where you have independent source saying, this is what I heard, this is what was being said, you come in and you make observations that maybe there was a struggle going on and there's some evidence of injury, you're going to err on the side of caution. Now, we can sort out the details later, but from a liability standpoint, you know, let's say you walk away from that situation and then somebody kills somebody, you know, one of the parties kills one another, you know, because the argument got flared up again. As an officer, then you got to answer that question to whomever, why didn't you arrest them in the first place? And so, you know, I can understand maybe the level of frustration sometimes with folks, but sometimes you got to put yourself in the other person's shoes. To me, you err on the side of caution, and we can sort everything else out later. I mean, that can be done either at the charging stage or that can be done at the, you know, the pretrial stage. There's always that opportunity to figure that stuff out.
So if a situation like that occurred and the officer says, well, hey, I didn't know what was going on, so I took him to jail because she had the bruises, and I'm going to let y'all figure this out. Now this guy and this female have to go into a court of law,
yep,
and say, this is a norm.
Yeah.
And you have to sit there and really listen to that?
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Explanation or sure. How would that, sure,
well, I don't
play
know,
out?
I don't know if we would get to court on that, but, you know, the way that it works for domestic violence cases is that we have what's called a domestic violence pretrial. So it's a pretrial specifically for a domestic violence case that usually happens within a week of the incident, all right? And that's a meeting between the victim and our office, and the defendant is required to come in. And a lot of times we work those cases out at that level. And so it would be at that level where we would get a sense as to what was going on. And then it's a matter of, you know, using your best judgment and trying to make a determination or a solid determination on what to do next. And it's based on your judgment. And, you know, whether it's myself or the people that work for me, you know, I'm trusting them to make good judgment calls. And they do. And ultimately, if it's a situation where it's really strange and you got to involve more people to talk, I mean, that, you know, well, that's why we, as an office, you know, what's great is that we're able, you know, you sit down and you start talking about, okay, here's what I got, and what do you guys think? I need a second opinion on this. And so we sit down, we listen, we talk about it, you know, and we try to figure out what we're going to do. The great thing about my office is that you don't have to sit on an island when you're making those decisions necessarily. You've got colleagues or you've got administration you can sit down with and say, listen, this one is really confusing the heck out of me. I'm not sure exactly what to do. I'd like a second opinion. Happens all the time.
So you ever had a situation, since you say you guys do that, where you walked in the office and you're like, look, got this case, and stuff just ain't sounding right, you know, and this is being said and that's being said, and they looked at you and it's like, we're going to leave that one all up to you. I don't even want to be in that mess.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, a lot of times it's, hey, whatever you're comfortable with, whatever decision you're comfortable with, or, you know, we may make a recommendation. You know, from my standpoint, I am not, and the rest of my administrative staff, we're not micromanagers. I'm not micromanaging, mm-hmm, you know, the decisions the assistants are making. Mm-hmm. If they come and ask for an opinion or you know, just say, hey, listen, what would you do? I'm going to give it to them, but I'm not necessarily directing them to do what I say. Mm-hmm. Now, there'll be certain cases where, you know, because of the nature of the case or whatever the case is, we're going to do it this way, and here, mm-hmm, are the reasons why we're going to do it this way. But that is the minority. That's very far and few between overall. You know, it's engaging in the conversation and saying, you know what, you do what you feel is best, and we'll support you 100% on that decision.
Hmm. Interesting. Maybe I should have went to law school.
Maybe you should have. you would have been an intimidating presence.
No, you got it. What's his name?
Tim Mott?
Yes.
My tall guy?
Man, that dude makes me nervous. I didn't like looking at him and... Yeah, that if he ain't got a smile on his face, I let him be. I don't even go say hi to him. I don't. I don't even say hi to him.
He is he's very even keeled, very gentle person. You can say hi to him every time.
Yeah, he had that look sometimes like I'm hitting with my 45, and if you move wrong, I got you. He got that look on his face. No, I'm just playing, Tim. Don't take that seriously.
That's
Tim.
Right.
Just joking. Well, our time is up, DJ, unless you want to go.
How about that?
Unless you want to go some more time, it's up to you. Well, you're the boss usually where you go.
No. that is so not true. Especially
at home.
Yeah, especially about 10 minutes from now when I walk in the door. Yeah.
That was made very clear. He's not the prosecutor when he comes home. Your wife made that perfectly clear.
She sure did, didn't she? So you can – she validated all the things that I've ever said.
Yeah. How are we looking for sports?
Well, listen, a couple of big football games last weekend. Mm-hmm. My second favorite team, my Broncos.
Denver Broncos.
They're playing in the Super Bowl.
Okay.
That was a great game against the Patriots. Great game. That second game.
I actually watched that game.
Yeah, the Carolina-Arizona game was terrible. I mean, terrible not in the sense that the Panthers won, but just terrible because it was so one-sided. Where in the Bronco game, it down to the last 15 seconds, man, you were on the edge of your chair. I know my entire family were watching this,
uh-huh.
And my son, my oldest.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. What was he doing?
He could barely contain himself. He couldn't sit still. And it's just like, man, they score that touchdown and how that last touchdown happened, I still am amazed. And then it got to the 2-point conversion, it's just like, oh my gosh. Don't go into overtime. Of course then it didn't, and he spent the next probably 2 minutes yelling and screaming, running around the house. Very exciting time for him. It's kind of cool because this is the second time in his life that the Broncos have made the Super Bowl, and I'm hoping that it's not one-sided like it was the first time. Because it could be a very short Super Bowl Sunday at the Hilson House, I'm just saying. So.
Oh.
So yeah, I mean, it was fun watching football a little bit. I had some work to do, but I was working and doing and watching football at the same time. So that was enjoyable. The Super Bowl hopefully will be enjoyable. That's not this weekend, but next weekend. So I'm looking forward to that.
Are you going? I mean, I'm quite sure you got tickets somewhere on the 50-yard line. Those tickets are what, $1,000?
Oh, yeah, right. I'm going to jump on my private jet, zip down there, and jump in the suite where us, public officials go, because I get invited to those games all the time. No, I'm still waiting for my phone to ring. John Elway, if you're listening, I'll take two tickets, please.
So who are you rooting for in the Super Bowl?
Who am I rooting for?
Anybody, any team in particular?
Well, the Broncos, of course. What are you talking about, who am I rooting for? That's a silly question. The only difficult thing would have been had the Packers made it.
How far did they get this year? I wasn't quite sure on that this year. I didn't watch much football.
Well, I know that the Detroit Lions probably watched it. I do know that. They were probably all – in fact, I know they were all at home watching that game. Actually, both games.
Yeah.
The game that when they beat the Redskins and the game that they almost beat the Cardinals.
Yes. Well,
there was a lot of – yelling and screaming, and then there was a lot of, oh.
Now, if Denver and Green Bay play in the Super Bowl one year, where is your son going to be?
Denver.
He don't care.
Nope, Denver. He'd root for Denver.
You and him would. Yeah, I can't wait to see him when he get a little older.
Well, listen, I mean, if you recall, in the history of Super Bowls, this would have been 1997,
uh-huh.
Packers-Broncos.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember what number, but And at the time, well, and this is true to this day, when the Packers play the Broncos, I root for the Broncos. I do not root for the Packers. I root for the Broncos. And that was true that year. In fact, I was in law school that year, and my parents made a special trip to Lansing just for the Super Bowl. And I know my parents are listening, and my dad remembers this very well because we're watching the Super Bowl, right?
Uh-huh.
And Green Bay comes out, boom, scores. I think it was to Antonio Freeman down the middle, touchdown. My dad is like, oh, here we go, here we go. And John Elway was quarterback of the Broncos at that point in time. I'm a huge Elway fan. I've loved him for all those years. And just watched the Broncos slowly whittle away and beat the Packers in the Super Bowl. It was a glorious day for me.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the next year, it wasn't a Bronco game, but I went to Lambeau Field. I can't remember who they played, but I wore my Elway jersey to Lambeau Field.
I'm surprised you got on it.
Listen, you got to understand something. Packer fans are very nice people.
Uh-huh.
And they were, you know, they weren't giving me a whole lot of business, but they were giving me a little business, but nothing, you know, nothing threatening or anything like that. Very respectful. But I was determined to do that. I had to do that, and I did. It was quite fun.
I can't believe you did that.
I can't believe my dad actually took me into the game, actually, quite frankly. But he did. And I,
with his cheese head on?
I proudly displayed my affiliation that day. Proudly.
Well, DJ, by the time you come back next time, it will, the Super Bowl would have been played.
Correct.
And we will have a lot of discussion on the Super Bowl, hopefully.
Correct. Yeah. Well, we got to start gearing up because March Madness is right around the corner.
Right around the corner.
Right around the corner.
And I got to start talking stuff.
Get your brackets ready. Get your bracket. You know what? We should.
Uh-huh.
We should, you know, it'd be fun to, as a radio station here,
yes,
have a little radio station bracket challenge.
Let's do that.
That would be fun.
I'm quite sure Paul would love that.
I'm sure he would.
If he ever makes it back from where he's at.
Right. Yeah. Mr. Vacation. You know, and if he's listening, he's like, I'm working.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you are.
The whole time I'm down there.
I'm working.
I ain't no vacation. I'm working. Wherever I go, I'm working. Watching the screens and everything, you know, and what you guys are doing in there, I can even see what you got on.
That's right. Working. No, I think that would be a lot of fun, you know, because as an office, we do a bracket for mm-hmm. the office.
Oh, okay.
And we have a traveling trophy that the winner gets to hold on to for a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. So it's a lot of pride. And then we have a family pool. We've got a really cool basketball. It's a big gold basketball trophy for
wow.
the family.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did the label, too. So every year you get your name on the trophy, the year you won.
Oh,
last year, my second son, Ryan, he won. So the basketball trophy is currently at my house with his name on it. My wife won it the first 2 years. She's the only back-to-back winner, if I'm not mistaken. And she's the only one that has her name on there twice. So
wow.
So yeah. So that it's prominently displayed
cool.
in my house.